On this episode of Ask Christian Counseling Associates, we focus on the mental health crisis on college campuses. Join us with special guest Lauren Watka Atwood, campus minister with InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, as we delve into the challenges facing students in higher education. Stay tuned for an expert analysis of young adult culture and key insights into an emerging problem that deserves our attention and investment. Welcome to Ask Christian Counseling Associates. I'm your host, Dr. Rich Hoffman, and today, special guest with me, Lauren Watka Atwood, campus staff minister with InterVarsity Christian Fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome, Lauren. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, I'm really delighted to be with you today.
Fantastic. We're going to talk about the mental health crisis on college campuses, and this has been a hot topic. People have been looking at statistics, and I think it's generally been said that since the pandemic, there is a literal crisis with people's mental health. Like no other time, people are struggling with depression, anxiety, the spike in suicides nationwide. And you have a personal experience with college campuses, college students. And so I'm just really excited to have you here today to talk about that, as there's so many people out there who want to have more information about that. So maybe we could start just, to talk more about your background and how you got to be with InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, and we can go from there.
That sounds awesome. I love that you guys are talking about this. It's actually quite in line with Gen Z. I mean, this is one of the generations that's much more willing to talk about mental health. That actually is quite trust building whenever older adults will even just bring it up, because it's a reality. It is a reality of their experience on campus, off campus. But before we get too far going down there, my background is actually in biology. So I'm a marine biologist by training. That's what I studied in school. That's what I continued in my master's degree. So I thought that's where I was going to be in science communication forever, until the Lord took me on a little detour about 7 years ago and invited me to come and work with InterVarsity Christian Fellowship.
Yeah.
And just for some folks,
just if I could jump in right there, that is a big change, from marine biology to college campus ministry with InterVarsity.
Yes.
Could you share a little bit more? Like, what specifically took place?
Yeah. What happened there? Well, I have learned in my journey with following Jesus that I want to say yes when he says, "Do you trust me?" I want to say, like, yes, I do, and go where he leads. And so I started following Jesus because of a campus ministry when I was 18 years old. There was a college fellowship, and that's what brought me to the Lord. So it's got a soft place in my heart. There was also a college fellowship when I was in grad school that sustained me through my research and intense years of my master's degree. So when I was invited to quit my job and come on InterVarsity staff, I wasn't immediately thrilled, but I sought the Lord. And when he said, "I want you to go this way," it actually made a lot of sense, because I have always loved being with young people. Maybe it's five-year-olds in tide pools, all the way to high school students at a program that I used to run. I love curiosity. I love discovering things with folks. And college ministry is highly relational, so I get to meet new people all the time. And it's full of discovery. College students are at this wonderful stage of life where they're deciding, who am I? Who am I going to be? What am I going to do? What are the core values that are going to drive the rest of my life? And so I get to be in some of that discovery space, curiosity space, and really come alongside a lot of these young people as they figure that out. It's my favorite.
Awesome. Yeah. So you're really loving the campus ministry and the opportunity that you've had now for 7 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
I jumped in a couple of years before COVID. So just as I was starting to figure out, I think, what am I supposed to be doing? What does this look like? COVID hit and really, well, as we all know, reoriented kind of all the ways that we were doing life, and ministry included.
Yeah, I'm interested in how that was for you. As we had people in our family in college at that time, My background, I teach at Methodist University in Liberia, West Africa. And so we have a hybrid program there where we do seminars, intensive seminars on site in Africa. Just came back from that a couple weeks ago, but then we teach online also. But before that, I was 10 years at the University of Pittsburgh. I was also adjunct faculty at Duquesne University, and we had a cooperative with St. Vincent. And before that, at community college when I was coming up and getting my doctorate. So it's very personal for me, you know, also. I just have a lot of background in this, but everybody was locked down on campus. You had students who were graduating, and there was no, they didn't walk into graduation. It was
no like ceremony, the there was no
video.
Ritual.
And, you know, on campus people who were told to stay in their dorm rooms at all costs and quarantine, mask wearing, you know, that was enforced with fines.
With fines. Oh, wow. I don't know if that happened up here, at least the schools I was on in New England, but wow, that's.
Yeah, at some point it was, you know, and these were, you know, there was differences all over the place, but yeah, you know, I can't come up with the exact fine that it was, but, you know, you would get reported. And then you would find out that you were getting a fine. It was somehow like levied to you as a student. So, so a lot of pressure, you know, and a subtext of if you don't do this, you're going to die.
Right. I mean, if there had been no increase or growing mental health awareness, even before COVID, if we had gone from a state of zero, of course there was going to be some increase with just the amount of fear and uncertainty that was everywhere. But we already had epidemic levels of loneliness going into COVID, and then it's just increased from there.
Right. So you come into this work during that time.
Mm-hmm.
That's very interesting. So tell me what that was like for you. How did you personally get through that, and what were the things that really stood out to you?
Yeah, one of the things that I love so much about campus ministry work is, at the end of the day, I long for every student to know the Lord, hear His voice, find healing and freedom in Jesus. And what I've seen is that happens in community. It's really hard to do that alone. And even when I read the scriptures, and even when, as Jesus has ascended, you know, when we celebrate Easter, He didn't leave, you know, individuals with like a little, you know, book to study. He left this community of people to figure out what it meant that their Lord was now raised from the dead. What is this new kingdom? What is this new reality we're living in? And on campus ministry, I see students discovering more things about God, coming to know Him like I did for the first time because of a community. And so when I started on campus, we could do that. We could gather for lunch. We would get together and do manuscript Bible study in person, you know, sometimes in a classroom, sometimes in one of the cafes on campus. And then I was actually on a spring break trip, like a volunteer spring break trip, when we heard schools were closing. And I remember the fear in this group of probably 100 students being palpable. Like, what do you mean I'm not allowed to go back to my dorm? Can I go get my stuff? What does this look like? And very quickly, my colleagues and I realized there has almost never been a greater need for students to know that they're connected, that they're going to be okay. Like, God is with them, and so it like a in eternal sense, they're going to be okay, but also we're with them here. Maybe not physically, but we have all kinds of technologies to stay connected. This like need to be connected was greater than ever. And so I love being in campus ministry, which is a para-church ministry, so we're not the church. We come alongside the church, and we're quite flexible. So we're like, okay, we've done Bible study in person. Let's do Bible study on Zoom. We've done discipleship sitting beside a student in a coffee shop. Let's do it as we're all taking walks and on the phone so that we can be outside and connect to our bodies and get out of our head a little bit. So it was, it certainly was a trying time to pivot so quickly, but and again, for me, I have a really strong community. I'm an extrovert. I wasn't living alone. I had roommates at the time. So I didn't feel the personal isolation the way so many did. And so for me, it was like, time to innovate. God, where's the creativity? Like, what are the new ideas? What can we try? Because there was such a need to stay connected. At the end of the day, that was my goal.
Let me jump into this. I have this
Yeah.
article here, and it's from NBC News. It says social media is driving teen mental health crisis. Surgeon General warns. Now, this is from a year or so ago. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, a long proponent of mental health awareness, has issued a warning that social media use is a main contributor to depression, anxiety, and other problems in the nation's teenagers. Now, I would extrapolate that out to young adults
Oh, yeah.
and then to adults.
And to adults.
That
Yeah.
that was one of the themes is wow, we can get this. We can pivot onto online, and relationships will connect. And maybe some people would say, like, social media, we're talking about Facebook and things like that, which I think is one of the main focuses in this article.
Okay.
But also social media is interactions through phones, online, and one of the things that we experienced during that time was, we maybe had 5% online sessions at that point.
Oh, right.
And then we were told, everything must be locked down, and we were mainly in Pennsylvania, but in all of our zones we were deemed life essential, and so we were able to have on-site,
Okay.
but it was restricted, and there was a lot of things that we had to do, and it all stoked fear. But this online component, to this day now, sometimes, I mean, it's 30%, 40%,
Yeah.
for a time it was over 60%. And you had the rise of things like BetterHelp and Talkspace saying that this is the future of how.
I was seeing my therapist online for probably a year and a half before we started meeting back in person. So, yeah.
Yeah, and we to this day have people who said, I want online only. And that's where they want to stay.
So I think there's an important distinction between social media and digital interactions. And I've been thinking a lot about this also with the church. I'm actively involved in a local church in Rhode Island. And I have some thoughts. They're not necessarily like, research, but for me, there's something different than posting on, let's go through the different generations, if it's like Messenger Kids or TikTok and Snapchat or Instagram and then Facebook. That's going through the ages. I think the social media of choice. And there's something about posting on one of those platforms into a void, getting, hearts or likes or maybe a little flame emoji, where you're showing a tiny little snippet without much context, devoid of relationship. It's not usually that vulnerable because it's outside of a relationship. There's something about social media that I've come to think of as manna in the desert. It's just enough, but it's not meant to sustain forever. It is a gift I think that we can use in small, limited ways that keep us superficially connected. But we need those deeper interactions where we actually have vulnerable connections and relationships with folks that are scarier because vulnerability is always scary. But I think a phone call can, which might be sort of digital, or even like a Zoom call with a friend, particularly during COVID when we couldn't be physically together, still allowed some of those deeper relationships being known in a way that we feel a sense of belonging and connection. that for me is the way of Jesus, right? The way of Jesus requires vulnerability, requires these authentic connections with, requires invitation for somebody to really know me and my story and my gifts and my struggles. And for a while, those had to be, well, in some ways, they had to be more digital. As things have opened up, I have seen a reticence, a hesitation for students to opt in to in-person interactions because it takes more time. Like you said, folks who want to just do therapy on Zoom, I can save the drive there. I can save the awkwardness of sitting in the waiting room if you're not ready yet. You know, I can stay in my PJs. I can be more comfortable.
Yeah, like, yeah, that's the way it's marketed, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And there's, I guess there's some gift to that sometimes, but so I've seen a hesitation for students to show up in person, whether it's an event on campus, a Bible study, a leadership team
meeting. Maybe that's one of the big things that I would want your opinion on. Because like never before have I seen the advent of online education and asynchronous. Yeah, so we do a lot of interviews here at CCA. We have a staff of 120, so we have a lot of intern staff who come in we do three semester experiences here for a whole year long. And now we're seeing the trend that a lot of them have never been on campus. And they've never met their professor. They see them on video, and then they have some kind of like chat back and forth, you know. But the real interaction is limited, and it's very popular. It's very convenient. I'm seeing these advertisements online. You know, you won't have to take exams in a schedule you don't want. You can make your own schedule. It's on your time, and man, has I'm going to sound, very old school to say, you know, I remember a time in another age where people would say that would never work, you know, and there's this, you know, going back to this article, there's a warning here saying, you know, this is not healthy for people.
Yeah.
And my assumption is this, you know, in relationship, the mind doesn't do well with fantasy. And the more that it departs from reality, clinically, you're off in these places where you get stuck. We can call it depression, anxiety, and, you know, in the worst cases, you would call it psychosis.
Yeah.
Where you're saying this person is not dealing with reality. And you have this theme in the culture that begins, I remember, way back now, Ready Player One. And it was...
You have to explain that to me. I'm not sure what that is.
Ready Player One. You should watch this movie. It's about this person.
Oh, movie.
Yeah, it's a movie. So Ready Player One, the movie, he is engaged in this social media world where all of his friendships are in this virtual reality. And, I was just contemplating how real that's become and how it's depicted in art to say that people would rather, you know, deal with this virtual reality and avoid all the pain. You know, what is the pain that we experience in reality? The time, you know, in counseling, it is the waiting room.
Yeah, awkwardness.
You know, the awkwardness of seeing somebody that you know. You know, the fullness of being in front of somebody and having an awkward moment, like you've said, that is completely neutralized in this. You're in Rhode Island, I'm in Pennsylvania, and we're going to get done, and I'm going to pivot right to the next thing. It's so easy, but life wasn't really designed to be that easy.
I don't think so. God didn't design us in video games. I think God is certainly creative, and we get to come alongside and build new things for sure. But even when I read in the scriptures, for some of your listeners who also identify as Christian, like when we see the intention of our God and where we're going, it is a city. There's partnership with humanity and discovery and architecture and all kinds of beautiful things and engineering, and there's a garden, but it's a physical reality. God meets us in reality, not reality, or like the, you know, a dreamland or something that I wish was the case. Like, God doesn't necessarily meet me in the future or in the past. He meets me now, because this is what's real.
Right. So, we're going to come back to the point in time where, you know, you're seeing all this pivoted to an online reality. You know, but oftentimes when people, you know, will really have tension about us saying, because part of our counseling program here is if you start in online, we want to get you into the office. Mm-hmm. And then we want to take it even further than that. You know, we want to go from individual counseling to group counseling, because our problems, yeah. And people are like, well, you know, what's this have to do with anybody else? Well, you live in a real community, and you've been affecting people, and people have been affecting you. We want to work in that real space. Yeah. And then, you know, and then there's a step beyond that, you know, that I'll talk about later. But, you know, within that, we say to people when they push back, you know, can you imagine me saying to you, you're going to be married to somebody, but we're only going to allow you to meet online. How absurd it would be to think that was healthy. And that is what some people are in, you know, today. They want to stay in this boat, and some of it's anxiety. I would also say one last thing. You know, I've seen people all the way up to you know, maybe a month ago, I saw somebody wearing a mask, mm-hmm. in a social situation.
Oh, yeah, I still see it, yeah.
Yeah, saying I'm afraid of what I might breathe in.
Yeah.
Yeah, it could kill me.
Yeah. The anxiety, the fear is very, very real. The question is what do we do about it? How are we coming alongside folks who are viscerally experiencing that fear and working through to a place where life can still go on.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe for our audience and for me, like, thanks for talking through that, because that takes us to the, you know, there was a lot of anxiety there, and you're coming into the college campus at that point. That's how you came into all this. So let's go back to that point. Tell us more. Okay, where do you go from there? You know, in your ministry and what you're noticing on college campuses.
On campus, yeah. One quick note, I care a lot about singleness. I heard you use the example of, you know, what if you were married to someone? And I always try to bring examples of friendship as well. I was single into my early 30s and really love reminding folks that, like, singleness is a beautiful also stage of life and sometimes calling. So I also think, what if you were getting to know your best friend and you only met online? I've been talking to a lot of students this past year around, how did you go from strangers to friends? And so very often, it's pushing through that awkward moment, choosing into vulnerability, asking somebody who you know in class, who you maybe sit beside, saying, hey, do you want to go grab lunch after this? Or if it's an evening class, hey, do you want to go grab dinner? Or I was talking to a student, she was in an art class, and she made some really close friends by inviting them to an art opening that was happening, but they had to drive off campus and, you know, go to a thing. But all of these, to your point, even with the marriage scenario, there is something about the in-person connections and experiences, like the uncertainty of life experiences, that I really think is necessary to develop relationships and that sense of connection. So being so sure of this, when I was on campus and saw such a pivot to online, I immediately became aware that I knew before some students were struggling. Now, this was key. I mean, if I was discipling a student, and sometimes my role is more as sort of like a coach, helping a student manage their time or think about their priorities. Sometimes my job is more executive, helping plan a movie night or like a welcome back event for students. And sometimes my job is as a pastor, and to love these students and remind them that Jesus loves them, and it's going to be okay to see what invitation God might have for them, what risk they could take with Jesus. And so when COVID hit, the mental health of students was so up front and center. I would say 90% of my job was as a pastor, was just, how are you? What's going on in your family? Are you sleeping? what friends are you connecting with? I'm not a big fan of video games, but I also realized during COVID that was a pretty key way some students and even some of my family members connected with folks. It was a thing that they could do together, even in like a digital space. So I could talk more about, I mean, some like statistics and what we've seen. But that I would say was a key focus for me, and I think is still an invitation for a lot of us, is mental health needs to be a conversation, needs to be talked about, needs to be normalized. I mean, it's growing more and more normalized.
Well, I always start with the connection. You know, lately with what happened during COVID, because yeah, there's a general thought that the mental health crisis, that's where it's coming from. It's a core cause. What would your opinion be on that? If we're saying, let's talk about statistics on college campuses. What part of this is the hangover from COVID versus we're dealing with something else that we're going to get into today?
You know, as a scientist, I'm very cautious to be certain about anything. I always like to hold a little bit of I'm not so sure. And detangling the current mental health, the state of mental health of young people from the advent of screens and particularly smartphones, the way that COVID accelerated a lot of what was already happening. And then let's even go back a couple more decades. We're also still in the shadow of like 9/11 and the war on terror and the recession in the late 2000s. Like when we talk about Gen Z, a lot of people say this generation is afraid. It's afraid of a lot of things. They're also blessed by God, and we can get to that in a minute, and have a particular, I think, calling to embody his image for this world now. But the environment that this generation has been raised in, the way their parents were parenting them, was with anxiety. So what did we expect to happen? Like, kids aren't playing outside as much. There's this absolute fear with a 24-hour news cycle. I mean, how can we pull apart any of these? I don't think it's wise to try. I think what we're seeing is the results of a very tumultuous last two centuries, the move of parenting to be much more structured, less free time. We are raising a generation of students who have less resilience than in the past. And I say this, and I would say this directly to some of the students I work with, that doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with them. That doesn't mean that they're not made in God's image, beautiful and important. But it does mean, I think, there's specific invitations for mental health workers like yourself, Rich, and pastors, just to be aware that the way of following Jesus, the discipleship, required, I think, to have whole life following of Jesus, and thriving and being able to hold suffering in reality, like we were talking about, is going to look different now than it did 15 years ago, than 10 years ago.
Yeah, I do. That resonates with me. I agree with what you're saying, that we don't want to say like there's something wrong with this generation. That's been
tried before. And I hear that a lot. And honestly, I sometimes feel that, and I have asked God to forgive me.
It's one of my favorite stories with, and I've told it on the podcast before. So yeah. You know, forgive me, viewers. You know, if you've heard this one, but you know, we were at this event, a retreat, and you know, the kids come forward and give their lives to Christ. And then we have this processing time afterwards, and we're saying, okay, this is the decision we've made. We're, you know, and this is what it means to follow Christ. And the doubt, you know, that goes around the room, and the mentions of, you know, this is what's wrong with me. This is my diagnosis. And I look at these kids and the character of them, and having spent some time with them, just really relating back to my childhood and being like, wow, these kids are so far advanced. That I thought I was doing great, and now like we're saddled with this different mindset, that is in the society now, that my identity is tied in with labels and all kinds of stuff that you do feel there's something wrong with you. When maybe this is a lot more, kids, young adults, facing life, facing the same challenge, and struggling with the same things. We just have a different mindset about it.
Yeah. I mean, everyone wants to know that they're loved. Everyone wants to know that they belong. Even as my colleagues and I have been talking quite a bit about what it looks like on campus right now. In some specifics, things are different. Even like I was talking about, some of the influences for this younger generation are different than the past few decades. But at the end of the day, we all want to know that we belong. We all want to know that we're loved. And what I think is so incredible about this particular young generation is they have an acute sense of everyone being at the table. They, I think, have an ability to embody God's heart for everyone. They want to make sure everyone is included in the community, in the group, in the dinner, in the kingdom. There's this deep sense of justice that I want to make sure we learn from and we see. In the past, well, I think a lot of this is a reaction to this generation having seen the church exclude this group or that group or this group, and they're looking around like, why? Wait, that doesn't sit with me. That doesn't feel right. When God talks about going after the lost, when he talks about in Revelation that every tribe and every tongue and every nation will worship before the Lord, they're like, well, then this friend should be welcome here. Then this other person should be here. And I've wondered if some of the anxiety comes from the tension. It played out. Oh, did you lose me for a second? I wonder if
Yeah.
I'm on a college campus right now, so
Yeah, I lost you for just a
testing in the
second.
Wi-Fi.
I lost your attention.
The tension that they feel with,
Well,
oh, I think some of their church communities is they're not seeing that same kind of grace and understanding and inclusion. They're trying to figure out what that looks like. If they have an identity rooted in Christ, then they are loved and seen by the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and they're also seeing some of these messages. Well, but this person's not included. I wonder if that's part of what this generation is wrestling with.
Well, and that definitely the environment in college campuses, if we could talk more specifically of, so they see groups excluded in the church. I wouldn't want to make an assumption right away. Tell me how that gets pulled apart. Where is young adults conscious of exceptions in church?
Yeah, I mean, at least in New England. So I've been up here in New England for the past, I guess, 15 years. My whole time in campus ministry has been in New England, and the question of the day is who am I, and how do we answer that question? So who am I? Is it a God-given identity? Is it something that this Spirit testifies, and Scripture tells us, and the Spirit testifies to, of like, I'm made in God's image in this particular way? Or is who am I something that I get to choose? I mean, if the the discussion around human sexuality and gender, there's so many other voices that are coming to the table of who am I? And what I see is the opportunity that I see, I would say, with young people is if we could remind them, college students in particular, if we could remind them, teach them, they want to learn from experts. That's another thing about this generation that I love. They want to learn from experts. They want to know that the information that they're learning is secure. It's like the person who knows what they're talking about. And so if we can step in as these mentors and remind them of, like, you don't actually have to figure all this out on your own. Who are you has already been given. Like, you are an image bearer of the Lord. At the end of the day, we are made to be in relationship with him and one another. Other things are secondary, but who am I is not something every one of us has to figure out on our own.
Yeah, so that is, hey, you get into the gender issue, or it seems like we would have to mention at this point the LGBTQ plus community, things like that.
Transgender, yeah.
Yeah, and so, how do you deal with that? Because that was one thing. So I taught psychology at the University of Pittsburgh for 10 years. I taught the same course. And in the intro psych, gender was one of the chapters. Mm-hmm. And it just, that 10 years, I saw that chapter remade 10 times until it said, you were born, biologically this, but maybe this isn't who you are.
Mm-hmm.
I know this is a personal question, but
where do you fall
on that as a pastor? And, what do you base that on?
Yeah. So I appreciate you said, like, as a pastor, kind of what do I do? Because there's a theological answer. If I was writing a paper, there is like a sort of church relationship answer. What does it mean? What do these questions mean in the church? And then there's a pastoral response. So when I meet a new student, this is maybe the second or third time that I've met her on campus, and she mentions that she has a girlfriend. She's new to the fellowship. I have no idea her background or faith background. And she mentioned she has a girlfriend. I almost knew in that moment it was a test. It was like, am I actually welcome in this space if I'm a lesbian? And that wasn't the moment to have a theological conversation about human sexuality and attraction. She actually didn't stick around for long enough for me to develop a trust with her that I approached that conversation. But it certainly wasn't, I wasn't going to say anything as we're on the quad, and this is the second or third time I've met her. So often with students, because I have a pastoral hat, knowing how tied gender and sexuality is to mental health, I can't ignore the statistics of the number of students who identify as trans who commit suicide. I mean, if we cannot ignore that, especially as pastors, we cannot ignore that.
What are your thoughts? That is a hot statistic. Why is there this elevation in the LGBTQ community of suicide? That has to be a big concern on university campuses, and there has to be strategy attached to it. And that must reach, inter-varsity Christian, however you see people answering that question, what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, again, I could have a theological answer. I mean, you can look it up online where inter-varsity stands, but for me as a...
If you could say, so we know the foundation, like, where does inter-varsity stand on that?
So there was a lot of research done. There was work done with folks on staff, and it's ongoing. The way that I put it is we have an Orthodox view of human sexuality. And so as we go through the scriptures and as we look at church tradition, Ultimately, marriage is between a man and a woman, and the way that God has made our very is our bodies, there's a reality in that, that we that we're invited to live by. That certainly includes the experience of what it is to be in our bodies or to have the attraction that we do. We need to kind of figure that out together. But as far as the convictions of the scriptures, when one of the students I've worked with shared that she was bisexual, this is a student I'd known for quite a long time. I asked if she was open to having a conversation about sexuality and looking at the scriptures together of what that looks like. And she said yes. So the way different campus ministers approach that, I know, is very, very different. Again, discerning what's the pastoral moment, and is a student open to learning, to looking at the scriptures, to praying, kind of bringing this part of their life and their experience to God along with all others.
Yeah. So standing on that foundation, you know, I would assume that you see the uncertainty in very foundational things that people used to be able to stand on, like I am a boy, I'm a man, or I'm a girl, I'm a woman. I know that either I need to stay single, or I'm going to get married to somebody of the opposite sex.
Mm-hmm.
Those are my choices, and you know, those foundations, a lot of people don't have those now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to your point a minute, or your question a minute ago, why do we see such a spike in suicidality or other mental health diagnoses in the LGBTQ and trans community? From some of the stuff I've read and I've tried to read and I've tried to continue to be curious, I mean, I identify as a cisgender heterosexual woman, and so I recognize somebody else's, I don't understand what it's like to be in a male body, right? I've never been in a male body. But when I think about the specific mental health stats that we read in the LGBTQ community, I wonder how tied it is actually to a sense of belonging and to a sense of, in the church, at least in the American church, that's the one that I know, predominantly like the evangelical church, there's a general rhetoric. There's a reason why the student who was a lesbian came up to me and she was sort of feeling me out. How is she going to react if I say I'm a lesbian? There has not been an overwhelming sense of welcome, not approval of behavior, but like welcome in the community, like welcome in the church to the LGBTQ community. And if that, I wonder if that has precipitated some of this mental health crisis. The reason I say that is, as a single person, I have observed a different standard in the church for celibacy for heterosexual singles and celibacy for homosexual singles. Like, if the church actually enforced the same standards for all singles, if we actually had a place in the church, if the church was slightly more like family, I don't know if there would be such a reaction to an orthodox view of human sexuality.
Well, this is interesting, and you know, I would have like a slightly different view. Although the thing that resonates with me is, you know, being single in the church is, you know, past 20 something is very isolating. That everybody there is married or they're not there. You know, and you know, in some churches,
where they want to be married.
Yeah, and maybe some churches can't relate to what I'm saying, you know. But I think that that's the context that predominates is married people or used to be married or that context, and so I could see that as not being, you know, easy if you are. And I've heard it talked about. What I, you know, really see, and this is a very controversial topic, to begin with, but
Oh, very
something
hard.
that we would need to talk about the reality of. And there's two things that I would lecture on, you know, to the church, to whoever. And these are you know, ideas, you know, that are based in experience and clinical research. They're not practice points, but you know, that would be first that in the United States especially, we've rejected God's design for family, and that has started with marriage. You know, so once you know, and that's the foundation. You know, without a male and a female coming together in a sexual union, you know, and God's design, that happens within marriage, you can't go anywhere from there. It's extinction.
As a biologist, I can explain to you how
there's
that works.
No, you know, asexual reproduction or anything like that. You know, that is, you know, one of the, you know, the primary modes of, you know, the family. And then, you know, from there, it's our identity, you know, within that family, and then it stretches out. So, because, you know, we have, you know, a devaluing of the permanency of marriage, you know, it's very difficult for people to feel welcome. And what I mean by that is, you know, what you need to do to stay in a marriage once you're in that. And, you know, all you married people out there, you'll, you know, hopefully you'll understand. There are wonderful things. It's the time of your life. It's the center of your life. But there are terrible things that happen in marriage. Mm-hmm. Things that it forces you to look past. Things that need forgiven. Flexibility that you did not initially have. And, you know,
autonomy that you give away.
You know, that's just, you know, and that happens also as you have children, you know, and even, you know, for those who cannot have children, you know, the context of people that you will take on, you know, through that foundation, what, you know, and what it stretches you to do, if you can do it, it's transformative, and you tolerate a lot of things, you know, and what that does to you in that transformation, you know, in your ability to trust, to forgive, to tolerate. I've not experienced anything else as an expert or as a person that could mm-hmm. do that. And I think that there's a lot of people, you know, who really have trouble engaging that now because they're told by the society that you don't have to. Yeah, you just start over again.
Like theology of suffering. Yeah.
Something gets tough. Just hey, start over again. We'll go through the first 5 years or 10 years of that, and we'll experience that part. But the things that happen in year 20, in year 30, you know, some of the harsh realities that really, you know, if you had people walking around like that was the majority, it would be a safe place for somebody to come in. Like people I disagree with. You know, after being in so many disagreements in my family that I have to give in on to make this thing go,
mm-hmm.
you know, that, you know, you find out, like, in those kind of families, you know, anybody can be a part of it. So I often say, like, we do these life groups in the church, and, you know, it's a familiar term, but we say to people, you don't have to be a Christian to be here. You know, all you need to do is tolerate that's what this is going to be. As long as you're willing to know, like, that's what we're doing here. As long as you're okay with that, you can be here. You know, because we value that your life is sacred. Because God breathed life into you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's goodness. You know, whatever reflection you are of God, that's the goodness that we have. You know, so without getting, you know, I'm not a pastor, so I don't want to get any more deeply theological. You know, some people say, like, you know, you can't have that person, and, you know, and they're not a Christian. They're like, what are you talking about? You know,
yeah.
If they're willing to hang around with us, you know, it's a safe place for them here. Doesn't mean we're going to agree. Because in families, you don't agree on everything,
right? Like,
Christian Counseling Associates is ready to serve you, providing a wide range of counseling services. Christian counseling is accessible to everyone. We serve both Christians who want their faith integrated into the counseling process or those holding any beliefs or attitudes toward spirituality. With many years of counseling experience, our counselors are professional, licensed, highly trained, and rooted in their commitment to their church and communities. CCA is able to provide a full range of clinical counseling services. For more information, visit our website at www.ccawpa.com.
I'm in an ecumenical ministry. In the student groups I'm in, I might have a Greek Orthodox, a Baptist, a Methodist, and like a Puerto Rican Pentecostal all in the same Bible study. We're not going to agree on everything, but the beauty of the church and why I'm so committed to the church is that we are invited to be together and figure out what it means to be together and love each other in the differences, like with our differences. And to your point around, there is something absolutely unique about a family unit. I mean, like you said, we procreate with a male and a female for sure. And I'm also going to say one other thing, that I was single up until my early 30s, and I have had reconciling conversations with friends. I've had to live with 9 roommates over the course of 5 years, I think. There are unique challenges and refining that also happens in friendships if we allow them. Like, if we actually invest into a community, say, I'm not leaving when I disagree with what the pastor just said, or I'm not going to leave because this person doesn't like my auntie, or, you know, I'm not going to just drop these relationships I've had. I know there's, you know, we're not talking about church trauma or church hurt.
I like what you're saying, though. It's the permanency of relationship that is a reflection of marriage that is an absurd concept in this world now. And has always been an absurd concept to the world, but in Christianity, it is the cornerstone.
It is. And I think there's also an invitation to friendships that go through the fire and come out on the other
Absolutely.
Side.
I love that what you're raising. And I would say, you know, getting back to do I belong, you know, there's always going to be the orphan and the widow. And there's these people like psychological orphans and widows. Who like I have nothing to belong to, and that's a long way around, I guess, is my theory on, you know, how that squares, is that, you know, because of the breakdown in marriage in the church, and I would specifically say how we've abandoned the teaching on, you know, marriage, divorce, and the possibility of remarriage, which is a strict concept, and you know, we teach that here because we're marriage counselors.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah, this will be your expertise then, not mine.
And so we know the theology of that, but I'll have pastors and certainly married folks be like, that's crazy. But I'm just telling you as you know, I've learned it, and it is what it is. You know, the church really has a tough time with it now. When you take it 2 generations back, you know, and I just bring up one, you know, I have no reason to be proud of my family, you know, as far as we're just as imperfect as other people. But, you know, my grandparents, who, you know, we didn't have many conversations around faith. You know, they got married when they were 18, stayed married until, you know, the end of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody they knew did the same thing. You know, and that was just how you did it.
Yeah.
You know, it's certainly, like, if we interview the people on college campuses today and say, like, how do you do this? You now have a smorgasbord of avenues before you.
Mm-hmm.
That we would say, we have no right to judge the effect of this one way or the other. You choose. And I think that, you know, that is the abandonment of family, and in that is there's a lot of loneliness. You know, whether you're single or you're married, the landscape is chaotic.
There's a lot of loneliness, and again, I feel like this, so much mental health is connected to having a sense of connection and belonging. And this loneliness and isolation, like you said, like how do we parse these apart? We really, we really can't. And I'll throw one other kind of idea in our little like fruit punch that we've got going on here is something that has been really striking to me over the last couple of years. So I've been married for 3 years, and I have a different theology of suffering than I did when I was single, and not I say this cautiously. I realize that I haven't endured, you know, really hard things. I won't go into my whole life story, but I wasn't really forced to grapple with what does it mean to suffer, to go through really challenging things, to trust Jesus in the midst of pain, not necessarily isolation, but grief over this life that I used to have and frustration over the limits that I currently have, both as a wife and I'm a stepmom now. And I've had to grapple with Jesus of what do I do when everything feels bad? Nothing's actually wrong, I don't think. There was nothing hard about my family system. My stepkids are fabulous human beings. I love spending time with them. My husband is so understanding and gives me more grace than I give myself. But moving from a state of singleness and also having lived in a city, now I live about 30 minutes outside of that city. Most of my core friendships were disrupted because I had built so much of my community around where I lived. Half of my week is not dictated by me anymore because that's when we have our kids. And I have had to wrestle with Jesus of, are you still good when things feel really bad? And I know that he is, like at the end of the day, and this is why I wrestled with it. I was like, God, I know that you still are. I know that you are faithful from generation to generation. I know that you are with me. You do not forsake me. But how do I find joy in these current circumstances? Like, Paul, what do you mean? I wonder if it's time for us generally as a church, if we really want to hold the discipleship of college students and young people seriously, I think we have to have a little bit more of a conversation about suffering and what does it look like in the church. There's one of the statistics that I was reminding myself of, and this is from Springtide Research, is 57% of young people say that they've experienced some type of trauma. I think, and I've heard other clinicians say, trauma is thrown around a lot more than it, you know,
yes,
clinically
that
actually means.
I would agree with that.
Yep, but still, if over half of our young people say that they have some sort of trauma, how are we talking about suffering? How are we dealing with that together? How are we bringing Jesus into that? How are we responding? If that's our reality, what do we do with that?
Yeah. Yeah.
The theology of suffering, let's put that in the mix.
Okay. Yeah. You know, and I just, you know, getting into statistics, you know, some of the things that I have just, and these are, you know, would take it a couple years back, but like 73% of students report moderate or severe psychological stress in 2021. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was, you know, since they measured in 2013. It was an increase of nearly 50%, and that was the National College Health Assessment.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying Springtide Research Institute would match up with that. Now, what was the percentage of students who would present with traumas?
57%. They've experienced trauma. I think that was a more recent publication because they also saw a huge spike in the 2021 report. That has gone down a bit more recently, but I'm pretty sure even still now, 47%, about half of students say that they're depressed. I'm pretty sure that's recent.
Yeah, so there's an issue there clinically that when we first started with trauma, with the advent of PTSD, you know, that coming out of the Vietnam War, you know, we saw a lot of this in very definable ways. We would when we thought about trauma, we thought about combat veterans.
Right.
You know, and now it is, you know, I was in class and I was offended and I experienced trauma.
I was traumatized, yeah.
You know, and you would have, you know, people who, you know, would really regard that synonymously, you know, like I have PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
And it's become part of our language. And that is, you know, definitely a concept. Say, I have trauma. That didn't exist, you know, until we really made it up. You know, and that's one of the criticisms of the DSM or the, you know, Diagnostic Statistical Manual.
Yeah.
That, you know.
Again, this is more in your field than mine, Chris.
Right. Like, I was coming in just when it was on the fourth edition.
Okay.
You know, and you know, I knew the clinicians who were, you know, on the third and the second, where the amount of labels have proliferated, you know, mm-hmm. and they're growing. You know, when we started out with Freud, there was anxiety. That's it. You know, that's, you have anxiety, and everything, you know, sprung from there. You know, whether they're saying this is hysteria, you know, there was a couple of different, you know, fancy words that were used, you know, we've evolved from that, so there's so many different ways to say I'm not doing well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the theology of suffering that you're saying, that we can expect to have to face painful things. You know, and
in this world you will have trials.
Yeah. And you know, we use the metaphor of the desert, that that Jesus had to face the devil in the desert wins. And you know, when we talk about, you know, Jesus as shepherd, you know, that, you know, if you understand the cultural, you know, vision of that, it, you know, the shepherd goes out into the desert with the sheep, and you know, to leave slavery, we had to, in the Exodus, go through the desert before we got to the Promised Land.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are so many instances of that theology, you know, where, you know, the desert is a place of trial or temptation. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, and it is one of God's design that we'll spend time with him there. However, you know, that we can rely on him for our survival. You know, it would more couch it that not like that God desires to bring pain, you know, to us. It is just the reality of what this place is.
Right. It is because we are not in the Garden of Eden. Like, I don't hear sin preached on very often. I'm trying to be more mindful, even in my own interactions with students, is just to bring sin up a little bit more frequently, because that's the reality that we're currently in. That's not forever. That's, like, God has promised that there will be a day where there is no more sin. But our current state is we live in a world that is beautiful and created by God, and it is also marred by sin, and we live in the tension of those two things. And if we're Christians, we're called by Jesus to endure suffering as he did the cross, and call out a new kingdom, and to call out the beauty, and to embody God's spirit in different places, and to work for things of justice, and to be in tune with the Holy Spirit's leading. It's so funny, this word reality just keeps coming up in our conversation. The reality is, things are not as they were ultimately, like, designed to be.
I mean, God's sovereign overall. So, you know, is that, you know, have something to do with this uptick in people becoming disturbed, that we've really, you know, as leaders of society, have begun telling generations that your reality shouldn't be that way, or you shouldn't have to face this. And, you know, we, on our way back from Africa, we were, you know, we would teach over there. We would tell the story to the students who are the students there are different. You know, their age range from 20 to 50, extreme poverty, you know, in Liberia, West Africa, and we're there to build a counseling system, and we teach psychology courses for people who are getting their master's and their doctorate. And in many ways, you know, the mindset there is the same in the United States. First of all, Liberia is a very Americanized culture, as they have a special tie with the United States that former slaves, you know, were repatriated to Liberia after the Civil War. And the tie and the friendship with the United States continued throughout history to this present day. So you're over there, you see American school buses going around.
Oh, okay.
You know, just very American things. But the point being, you know, they're suffering there, and they're asking the question, you know, how should we face this? And we tell the story of the Johnstown flood. Johnstown, Pennsylvania is about an hour and a half outside of Pittsburgh to the east. And there was a dam that broke, and it flowed into this valley and completely wiped out you know, a large city. And so there's this museum. And as a young counselor, I would take kids who we did activities. We'd take them there. And I remember this picture. And this was the story that I told, that the historian told us, was these pictures of these miners. And they were dressed in full suits. And you can tell it was this picture of them out in a mud-caked field in this field office where they would collect their paychecks. And the story goes that they would dress up to get their paychecks to say, our work is valuable, and we want it to be respected. Mm. And they were destroying their bodies in the mines, if you know what it is to be a coal miner. Working long.
Not personally, but I've heard about it.
There's a long history here. You know, the Steel Valley and the coal mines, you know, they go together here, and you have generations that have worked those types of jobs and industries. But they would destroy their bodies in the mines. They would work for little pay, over 10 to 12 hours a day. You know, 7 days a week, a lot of these jobs, their whole careers. And in this case, these miners in this picture probably got wiped out in the flood. They knew it was going to happen. They knew that whatever they were building, they would never get to see it. But they knew they were building something. You know, and that's what they're saying, that's valuable. Like, look at what we will do. And they knew that was life. Like, you gave your life to your family and the community before you asked for what was for yourself. And not that was done perfectly, but that was a major value, where in those jobs, that was sacrificing yourself. And they did. And that's what this country, especially in our area, we benefit from the work that they did generations later. And we don't think like that anymore. You know, it's much more likely that you try to decide what's right for yourself and then convince everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that life, you know, should not be one of facing some harsh realities for the good of everybody, and knowing that you can make a life out of that. And that there is times of joy in that, and there is goodness.
Oh yeah.
And there's worth, you know, that your life means something. You know, so we would tell the people of Liberia that, because they're facing, you know, they have to rebuild after a 20-year civil war, and the reality is that they're looking at 10 to 12 hour days for the rest of their lives to be able to do it. And what they'll rebuild, they might not ever see. And in their minds, they've been so demoralized by some of the hardships that they don't believe that that's worth it anymore. They don't believe it can happen. And I, you know, truth be told, you know, for a college student, you know, who's looking at, you know, what's this gonna be?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just think of what kind of messages do we send we're not sending this, you know, the reality of this is that there's some pretty harsh things you got to face, and you can. And we're with you, and it's just part of life. It is more of like, you know, that's trauma. That's, you know, that means there's something wrong. This pain that I feel means that I have a disorder. You know, and so yeah, like I think that once that gets into the mind, you want to avoid it. You want to run.
Yeah, I think we have been more discipled by. And again, speaking to the American church here, I think we've been more discipled by a goal of comfort than the kingdom, and of individualism than a self-sacrificing posture. Like, and it's so interesting, in the mental health world, I was just talking to someone who's a friend who's training to be a counselor, and he said, it's tricky because often in the mental health world, our goal is for someone to be happy and productive. But happiness isn't the end goal when I read the scriptures. Happiness comes along the way. Like, I also think there's a false understanding of if it's hard, then it's the right thing. Like, if it's sacrifice, it's always the right thing. That's not necessarily the case. But that there will be trials. There will be moments in the desert. There might be years in the desert. There's going to be conflict in relationship. There's going to be rejection. There's going to be hurt. There's going to be misunderstanding. I wonder what it would be like if the church actually could be a prophetic voice to our country in some ways, to shift the expectation. Because if I know that, like, oh, things are going to be tricky and maybe some social situations are going to feel really uncomfortable, I might be able to hold social anxiety slightly different, instead of thinking, oh, I don't think I have the resources to show up to this party, there must be something wrong with me. Like, if we actually understood, sometimes social situations are going to feel extra hard. If we had empathy for that and could come alongside each other. Again, if we had friendships where we were talking about that to a friend and had some empathy, and it wasn't just pushed into what I call shadow and shame of, like, well, nobody can know that I feel uncomfortable going to lunch with people because then they won't like me, or all the different narratives that we come up with. I wonder, and I don't know this again, but I wonder how that might change how we think about mental health, how we deal with it.
Yeah, you know, and I want to make sure that I carve out some time, because, you know, you being a college campus expert, I want to give you some time to, like, you know, maybe in a brief way, encapsulate the issues that students are facing that point to these statistics. Because again, I think people are just very interested in, like, what is going on, But I would say there's a theme in what you're saying that we focus on in clinical counseling. And you know, if I was just allowed to geek out for just a second on this, you know, and just have patience with me, because this is what we do all day long for years, we work in a set of research called contextual behavioral science. And so there's this approach that's based off of that called acceptance and commitment therapy. Now, the secular part of it is not something that we completely endorse, but we believe that it can be adapted and be consistent with a traditional Christian worldview. And so our clients, you know, will get that approach here. And the approach is basically, you know, put together a lot of credible research that says the chief impetus for people to really experience a lot of emotional dysfunction is avoidance. That they get something happens, and then they start to get into this pattern of avoiding, you know, feelings, thoughts, and ultimately, you know, all of what they're about. And as that happens, they become more and more detached from reality, and they become severely disordered, you know, along a spectrum. And, you know, it goes along with some you know, some old school things that we, you know, we used to hear about that would, I would never say clinically to, you know, to anybody, you know, who I'm working with, you know, but my parents used to say, you know, you can't run from your problems. You know, you if you're scared of that, you need to face it. You know, you don't want to go to that party, you need to go. You know, and you know, but the clinical, you know, research on this is a little bit more complicated. It sort of maps out that once we get into this kind of cycle, and we don't have support for really dealing with something, we start to live in the future, which is oriented to anxiety, or the past, which is oriented to depression. We tend to conceptualize ourselves with labels instead of really understanding that, you know, thoughts and feelings are very surface level things that happen in us, but we're more deeply, you know, at the heart, you know, we have a purpose. And so, you know, there's these important things that transcend feeling. So I might feel bad about today, but I know that my life still has value, you know, and then, you know, from that becomes goal directed behavior. You know, so I still have a direction, even though, like, there's a lot of noise in my mind. Mm-hmm. And naturally, what happens when I have that direction, those things get put to the side. They don't go away. You know, so truth be told, everybody deals with depression. Everybody deals with anxiety. Everybody has trauma. You know, when we become unhinged from who we truly are. You know, so we're not a label. We're not who our sexuality is, like you're saying. We're not our status and whether we're married or single. You know, there are deeper things. Christianity points to that.
Yeah.
You know, and ultimately, as a Christian, I would say, who God made us to be, the purpose that He gave us, the direction that we can have from that, gives us a clear way to face our problems. You know, and realities change. You know, from thinking I should feel no pain, and you know, and I've been told that in the emergency room, you have the right to feel no pain. I don't know if you've ever heard that. That's an old one. They stopped saying
that. I haven't. Oh, wow.
But they used to have the smiley face to the sad face, and you'd have to rate your pain, and then for a while they stopped that when they figured out that these painkillers were becoming an epidemic. And then they started actually putting the primary care physicians, they were sending them to jail for a while for prescribing. But it all started with, we don't want you to feel any pain. I don't know, you know, in what medical circle that started out with, but that was, you know, that was mid-90s.
And I see the goodness in that. Like, I see the initial intent that has since gone astray.
Yeah. Yeah, so this contextual behavioral science, you know, piece where we have to really let things go through our mind, feelings, thoughts, and not grab onto them, not ride along with them, not become fused to them, but understand that we're more than that, you know, and to be in touch with something deeper spiritually, and let that guide our life is what even the secular science is saying that we have to do in clinical counseling to get somebody in the right mind. And everything that you're talking about is consistent with that. So I really appreciate your viewpoints. And again, I want to give you some time now, you know, cause, you know, thank you, you know, for letting me mention that, but,
oh, thanks for sharing that. That tracks with what I have seen God do in the lives of students that, I'll pause. Go ahead and share your question.
Okay. You know, my question would be, you know, we've covered a couple of things, but at this point, so we just sort of bring it back to what are students facing that's really spiking these statistics, the mental health crisis. In your expertise, what are you seeing that you could summarize for the folks?
Well, I'll also take the permission to share some stories. I've learned as a communicator, one of the best ways to share concepts is actually by stories. I don't know if I've done a great job of doing that so far.
You're doing great.
Three students actually come to mind that I've known from a couple different campuses. One, I met her before the pandemic. She was a freshman art student, and we met her just in the cafeteria. We were giving some things away. And she seemed spiritually curious, had a little bit of a background in Catholicism, hadn't been to church since she got confirmed. That's pretty common in Rhode Island. And we invited her to this exploratory Bible study that we were starting. And she said, sure. It was, I think, the next day. And I texted her the next day, and she told me later she wasn't going to come until she got that text from me. And she said, okay, I guess I'll go. You know, I'll go once. But she was scared. She didn't know us. So I know that there was discomfort that she felt showing up with these new people talking about the Bible. But from my perspective, God had given her the courage and at least inspired enough curiosity for her to show up. So she sat with us for 5 weeks and looked at the scriptures with us, looked at the person of Jesus. We had these exploratory Bible studies are so, so fun for me because students come from all different backgrounds. And I know that if I was to follow a worldview of stay comfortable and happy, oh, she wasn't happy. She was quite depressed as a freshman, feeling very lonely. Had actually come out of a period of suicidality. I didn't know all of this until much later. But she came to this Bible study even though she was uncomfortable, even though it was quite a stretch. I would say she, maybe not fearful, but uncomfortable for sure. And God encountered her on then COVID hit, and so everything went online, and so we had some of these gatherings online, and she kept coming. And it was actually a Maundy Thursday, and she heard the story of Jesus washing the disciples' feet. She actually heard the story of the cross and resurrection for the very first time, and she felt God telling to her personally, I know the hardship you've been through. I know the suffering that you've gone through. And when you started to turn the corner, when you realized life was worth living, that was me. Like, that was me bringing you back to life, essentially. And she decided to follow Jesus. And she's a Christian to this day. She would not have found that new life in Jesus. She would not have known his constant presence and comfort through COVID had she not stepped into that discomfort multiple times of coming to a group that she didn't know and showing up in person again and again and again. It was much easier to get smoke while she was at home, to be playing her video games and numbing the pain that she felt. So if you want to know some real things going on college campus, those are two big ones. Like, marijuana is especially since now it's legalized, it is a numbing tool.
So there's a lot of people who are using legal drugs now.
Exactly. And I mean, let's just throw in, I'll talk about social media with another student, but for this student in particular, marijuana was a big numbing. I don't want to feel pain. I don't want to feel this loneliness. So let me just escape. She is now sensing, she's now out of school. She is sensing God's invitation for her to actually trust him with that addiction, with the pain that she feels whenever she's not smoking. So that's a reality happening on college campus. Another student I knew, and he was the mayor of the school. He walked into the cafeteria and the dining hall. Everybody knew this student. I mean, good vibes everywhere. Like, he just, you know, hey, gregarious, just a fun person to be around. He also had a really strong party life because he thought that that's what it meant. Like, that was acceptance. That's what he was supposed to do at school. And he had a profound encounter with God where God essentially said, the things that you're doing will lead to death. And I think it was actually quite literal for him. There was some other health stuff coming up for him. And not just the wages of sin or death, but like the choices you are making are not leading to life. And he really turned himself around. A big moment for him was getting off of Instagram, because for him, having to show up, everything's great, hey, love you guys, I look awesome, you look awesome, getting that constant feedback, that was a real strong driver for him. And what he later identified was his own pride and sort of self-focus. So he stopped using Instagram for, I think, a month, and then was really like kind of walking with Jesus of how much he was going to be on that type of social media, because he realized the draw of this external validation. I'm okay if these other people like my picture or my reel or whatever it was. Oh, so strongly. Another student I know, she started realizing how actually addicted, she used this word, addicted she was, again, to Instagram, because that's the soon, I think TikTok will be up with Instagram, but I think that tide might be changing, but at least over the last couple of years, Instagram was the biggest one. And she realized she was feeling physical anxiety when she hadn't posted in a little while or people hadn't responded the way she thought. And she realized, I think with a therapist, that she needed to distance herself from social media. I think she was off for maybe 3 months. I mean, I've heard people talk about a social media detox. We're using addiction language to talk about social media now. But she, super talented student, just lovely, lovely human being. And it was with the help of a therapist that she realized, she even had some in-person friendships. She had folks she could call on a hard day, but the draw of the external validation and affirmation from Instagram was so strong for her. She was willing to endure the pain and discomfort of, I'll use that same word, like detox, because she knew that it was better on the other side. She had the support of a therapist, which was really important.
Yeah.
But I think in all of these stories, I see these students being willing to lean into discomfort, but sometimes from God's invitation and sometimes from the witness of their community of like, this is not good for you.
Yeah. And there used to be some articles about people who, you know, if you took their phones away, they would start twitching. And I think it was there was like a story about a football team that couldn't text or something. But it really, to use an addiction type viewpoint of that, it really fits in a lot of ways.
I think it's accurate. The more I see it, like, it feels really, really accurate. The fear and the withdrawal when I don't have my phone, I see it not only in students but in some of my cousins. It's very real. I think adults, we really need to take that seriously. That Surgeon General warning around social media that you mentioned previously, I don't think we can take that seriously enough. I actually had a friend who just published a book. Sarah Cowan Johnson, she published this book, Teach Your Children. It's about discipling and raising up the next generation. She right now is focused in her work around digital discipleship and helping parents think about social media use in our kids, because she, oh, I wish I had the specific quote. It's something like, if the same stats for depression, anxiety, and suicidality were associated with a chemical, with a drug, it would be banned. So why are we not doing something more proactive around social media? And right, the economics, you know, the money that is built into this system is strong and is real, and I'm sure that's a big part of it.
But, yeah, it's unlikely that we're changing course unless something drastic happens.
What's going on?
But you're definitively saying social media is something that people are engaging in. It, you know, what we see, like, it revs up your life. Like, you know, if it puts you into a fantasy that's pleasurable, and that's where it becomes addictive, this appreciation, this contact with everybody, this way that you could position yourself to get max impact, it could really take you over.
Yeah.
But it also leaves you empty and just as dysfunctional as if you were, in the last example, smoking marijuana every day,
right?
and not really able to engage real life.
Yep, it's a numbing tool, and it clicks us out of reality. And like you were saying, it is so imperative for us to stay rooted in reality. And that's where I saw the courage of some of these students to lean into discomfort or acknowledge pain, because that was very real. They got to a place saying, like, I don't want to numb anymore, or I need to figure this out.
So these are some great observations, and again, maybe and I don't know if this would make any sense, but you know, when you're really in it, you know, you see some things that are just privileged, you know, that only somebody in your line can realize, you know, having been there. Is there anything that comes to your mind like that? Like this is something, you know, that maybe the general public just doesn't even, they don't even know that's going on. And I think you've already told us a couple of key things, like the one to me that really blows my mind is contemplating what the legalization of marijuana has done, because, you know, college campuses were pro, you know, beer drinking and using drugs before, now we've infused. So that's I think, a big thing to realize. But yeah.
Yeah. What else? I mean, it's so funny that this is now my my everyday life. So what is unique? What is different? I feel like we've talked a fair amount around, like, oh, what are some of the challenges? I also see students working really hard. You know, I see them balancing jobs and classes and trying to figure out this, like, friendship and social media stuff. Like, I see this generation figuring out the generation that they're in. I see these students trying to, you know, be part of the theater group on campus and step into the fear of leading part of Bible study. Like, I don't know if I can do this. Like, I see them getting overwhelmed.
Yeah, would you say that they're exhausted? You know, one of the things I saw as a professor was, and I don't know where I got this, so you can correct me, you know, but it was something like, for every credit, you should be studying 3 hours per credit. So if you have a 3-hour course per week, you know, if you had a 3-credit course, that would mean 9 hours a week you should be studying psychology in my class. And, you know, it becomes, if you have a full caseload, that's your full-time job. You know, but I started surveying students, and I realized that most of my students were working full-time jobs and going to school full-time, which would mean that under that model, they were looking at 80 hours per week.
Yeah.
And the truth be told, some of my students, you know, just saw, like, they didn't have any time to study, and they're just completely overwhelmed all the time, failing tests that were passable, of course. You know, maybe that sounds biased, but you know, would you say that students are overwhelmed, that they're working, you know, because they're working?
I don't know if it's because they're working, but this word overwhelmed is something I have recently learned is not the same. So as a campus minister, I think about myself as a missionary. This is a people group that I am learning. So even if I was going to, you know, Southeast Asia or somewhere in, you know, Northern Africa, like, there's a language, there's a power structure, there's a culture. And so I've realized, oh, I need to, again, relearn this particular people group, which includes language. Overwhelmed is a word that I hear more often, but it means something different than what I thought it used to mean. If I was in school, I'm like, yeah, I'm overwhelmed. I have a couple tests this week and, you know, 3 lab reports. That meant I was stressed, but I was holding it all together. I just had a lot of work. Overwhelmed these days, I have learned, means I actually am I'm either overcommitted or I have too many things. I actually am shutting down. I cannot continue to fulfill the responsibilities that I have. I get canceled on a lot. A lot. And often it's because students are overwhelmed. They either are picking up another shift at work, or they forgot they had a test that they had to do later. And so our afternoon meeting, they cancel because they have to study for their test, or if they have to write their paper. So I see, I think I mentioned before, a difference in resiliency with this particular generation. I don't necessarily know if it's their multiple jobs or roles that they have. students are still involved in extracurriculars. They're still involved in jobs. They still have classes, especially the commuter schools I work on. They have their connections at home. They might drive their nephew to daycare or something like that. I don't think that's changed. I think our internal resilience and ability to deal with that stress has changed over the last couple of years. This is where I hand it over to you, Rich. I don't know what to do about that, but I've seen that difference.
Yeah, we help people with that a lot to reorder their lives, you know, and get their minds in a new order, and that's definitely possible. Know, that if you're falling apart, as a college student, you should go see a counselor. You know, that would be one of my recommendations, of course. And you know our bias, see a Christian counselor that's going to tie you to a community of counselors, and that'll be the church, and belong to that. We see so many people disconnected or have canceled church. You know, but let me bring this back to you, Lauren, for just one more piece here, and that, you know, if you were to give some recommendations to students who are facing the challenge, and then we would end it out for the supports of the students, the parents, the family, recommendations to them, what would be your expert advice?
Oh, well, of course, this was how we're going to wrap up. For students, I really like, these days, I like to give students different levels of challenge. And so sometimes we call it, like, how spicy do you want to go? So I would say first level of challenge, if you're a college student, make a friend. Like, do maybe a hard thing of, actually, that's going to be level two. Level one is join something. Just show up. You don't actually have to talk to anybody. You don't have to sign up for leadership. You don't have to speak, but show up at something and go again. So find a thing that you like to do, but get involved in a community on campus. If there's a faith community, go there. They'll probably be awkward, but they love you in the best way that they can. Second level of spicy, I would say, is make a new friend, and that's going to require a step of vulnerability, and usually and what I mean by that is the possibility of rejection. So invite somebody to grab lunch. Invite somebody, if you're an athlete, invite somebody to, like, hang out and study before practice. Or if you're, you know, an art student, go to a local gallery. Everybody eats, so invite somebody to a meal. The risk always is somebody will say no. But that's why it's that second level. And I would say the third level is do it again. Like, just continue.
More friends, to lean into more events.
Yeah, just, like, lean into those places of vulnerability. And especially if you identify as a Christian, know that no matter what happens, you're going to be okay, because Jesus is still with you and he loves you more than anybody. So those would be my advice for college students. And for the supports for the parents, counselors, faith leaders, teachers, mentors, I am constantly surprised at how meaningful it is when I just reach out to a student. Honestly, they text. Like, this is the main way that you're going to communicate with them. So you don't necessarily have to be on Snapchat. You don't necessarily have to be on Instagram. They text. They may not get back to you for 5 days, especially if they're overwhelmed. Don't take it personally. But I have been surprised over and over of how meaningful it is when I just check in on a student. Especially lately with some of the violence around ethnicity and race and our international issues. If a student identifies with a particular ethnicity that is, you know, in the news for some way, shape, or form, name that. Hey, I saw this happening in the news. Wanted to check in. How are you doing?
Yeah, so we have a church that they'll select people within the congregation to send stuff to the student. Maybe it's like, I don't know, like a
cookie. Like a care package kind of thing?
Care package. Yeah. That's effective. That really is a nice thing.
Oh, absolutely. Like, somebody is thinking of me. Like, somebody actually cares about me. You might not necessarily get a handwritten thank you. I try to teach my students the students I work with to do that. But I think that might be slightly of a bygone era. But again, this is a generalization. I'm sure some students might disregard it, but it is meaningful. And especially those cross-generational, like this, college students are looking for mentors. They're looking for people to show them the way, to show them what to do, to disciple them. The number of students who I know who are like, I've never been discipled before. It doesn't have to be fancy. Just take them out to coffee and ask how they're doing. How is their soul? I'm sure you could like Google Christian mentoring questions to ask. Actually, ChatGPT can also come up with some good ones. A friend of mine did this a bit ago, and it was very funny. But it doesn't have to be fancy. You don't have to do it great. But there is something about the ministry of presence and just being with students and not being afraid if they're going through a hard time, not having to fix it, but really being able to listen and say, that sounds hard, or wow, that sounds exciting, and just reflect what's going on in their life. Oh, that is so powerful.
Okay, so taking on a mentoring role is something that could be powerful and welcomed with the students.
And welcomed.
Well, this has been great, Lauren. I really appreciate your insights. And, I want to just invite the possibility of you coming back sometime, especially I know in the future there's going to be events that touch the college campus, in a traumatic or a special way. And I would love for you just to shoot us like an email or text to say, like, I'd really like to talk about this. I think the viewers would really get something and give you a chance to give us this perspective again. It's really been a great time, to hear about this, and it gives us a lot to think about. If I could ask for a final thing, would you say a prayer for our college students out there, and we can end that way?
Oh, I would absolutely love to. Thanks for the invitation, Rich, and I would love to pray.
Thank you.
Oh, good Jesus. Lord, I'm just constantly in awe at the world that you have created, your people that you have created so beautifully, so diversely, so uniquely. And specifically for this generation of college students, God, I pray a blessing of their identity. Would they know that they are so rooted in you, that you can be an anchor amidst, swirling seas, God, that you can be the thing that they cling to and say a lot doesn't make sense. And I don't even know what of Jesus that I've learned is like fully true, because there's so many things that are deconstructing. But God, I pray a blessing of rootedness in you for this generation. God, I pray that college students would hear that you are created beautifully. You have a purpose and a calling in the kingdom. God, would your love once again pour out on college students? Would there be a peace that passes understanding? Oof, in the name of Jesus, would there be peace that passes understanding in college students, both in New England, the Northeast, and across the country? Holy Spirit, pour, peace. That is what I'm praying. That is the blessing that I'm praying over students. Would there be peace and certainty in their minds and their hearts that what you've made is very, very good, that their minds and their bodies are made very, very good, and you delight in them, Jesus. You rejoice over them with singing. And God, I pray for those who have been hurt by the church or feel far from you, God, that they would make their way back to you. They would come and see that you are good, that they would experience your love and your presence afresh and anew. And they would actually teach their friends, this is really what God is like. So, Jesus, we know that you will bring to completion the good thing that you have started, and you have started a good work in this generation, and so we trust you. We trust you with the fruit. And so we love you, Lord. We pray all of this in the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Amen. Amen. Well, Lauren, thank you for being with us. Thank you for all that you've shared. And folks, thanks for watching Ask Christian Counseling Associates. We'll see you next time.